Chapter 22. In the event, Mr. Bennet hardly spoke at all during dinner. He allowed himself the merest ghost of a smile when Mr. Collins, praising the food with the same extravagance with which he had admired all the other distinguishing marks of the house, asked to which of his fair cousins he was indebted for its cookery. Mrs. Bennet replied with some asperity, observing they were very well able to keep a cook, and none of her daughters had anything to do in the kitchen. Chastened, Mr. Collins rushed to make amends, and continued to do so long after Mrs. Bennet considered herself appeased. It seemed to Mary as if he spent quite 15 minutes apologizing, whilst everyone else stared, embarrassed, at their plates. But it was only when all was cleared away, and the servants had withdrawn, that she saw her father compose his features into an expression of polite inquiry, and devote himself to the agreeable task of exposing as many of his guests' failings as was possible before the coffee was brought in. He began by declaring that Mr. Collins seemed very fortunate in his patroness. Could he enlighten them any further about Lady Catherine de Bourgh, who seemed so solicitous of his comfort and well-being? He could not have chosen a better subject. Mr. Collins was eloquent in her praise, extolling her affability and condescension, her graciousness in approving his sermons, her generosity in inviting him to dinner, her extraordinary civility in sometimes asking him on a Saturday night to make up her pool of quadrille when another gentleman had disappointed her. For a lady of her rank, such behaviour was as exceptional as it was pleasing. She had even seen fit to distinguish his humble parsonage with a visit, and had approved all the alterations he had made there, although she had been kind enough to inform him the upstairs closets required more shelves. As he blundered on, the pity Mary had begun to feel for him grew. Her sisters, she knew, had already dismissed him. She could not say that she herself found him an admirable character, but she knew how it felt to hear one's words greeted with puzzlement, scorn, or indifference, and her sympathy for him increased, even as he seemed determined to make his situation worse. "Lady Catherine seems far more agreeable than many great ladies," observed Mrs. Bennet. "I believe, sir, that she is a widow and that she has a daughter?" Mr. Collins agreed this was so. "What kind of young lady is she? Is she considered very handsome?" "It was unfortunate," replied Mr. Collins, "that Mr. Bourgh did not enjoy the good health usually considered essential to beauty. But, as he frequently assured Lady Catherine, her looks were of the refined kind which marks the young woman of distinguished birth." "Has she been presented at court, sir?"
"Her indifferent health unhappily prevents her being in town," Mr. Collins explained. "As I told Lady Catherine, this misfortune has deprived the British court of its brightest ornament."
He looked around, as pleased with himself as he was with his remark.
"I am happy on every occasion to offer those little delicate compliments which are always agreeable to ladies."
Mary closed her eyes for a moment. He had surely sealed his fate now. She saw her father sit up.
"I have more than once observed to Lady Catherine that her daughter was born to be a duchess," continued Mr. Collins. "These are the little things which please her ladyship, and it is a sort of attention which I conceive myself peculiarly bound to pay."
"You judge very properly," said Mr. Bennet, "and it is happy for you that you possess the talent of flattering with delicacy. May I ask whether these pleasing attentions proceed from the impulse of the moment, or are they the result of previous study?"
"They arise chiefly from what is passing at the time," replied Mr. Collins, "and though I sometimes amuse myself with composing such elegant little compliments as may be adapted to any occasion, I always wish to give them as unstudied an air as possible."
Mr. Bennet nodded, delighted to discover that his cousin was quite as absurd a figure as he could possibly have wished. Nothing in his features betrayed his pleasure. Apart from a glance or two at Elizabeth, he gave no sign of it. Mr. Collins himself, was quite unconscious of the judgment that had been passed upon him, raising his glass in happy ignorance of his condemnation. But Mary was ashamed. It seemed a dishonourable thing to treat a guest in such a manner, even when he was as foolish and silly as Mr. Collins. When they rose from the table and made their way to the drawing-room to take more coffee, Mary attempted to speak a few kind words to her cousin in recompense. She trusted his journey had gone well and that he was not too tired. Was this the first time he had been in Hertfordshire? He answered perfunctorily, his eyes searching for a seat which would place him as close as possible to Jane. Throughout dinner, he had smiled at the eldest Bennet sister with a warmth which was not returned, but he appeared not to notice her coolness. When the general conversation petered out, everyone having exhausted their stock of empty politeness, Mr. Bennet suggested that their guest might entertain them by reading aloud. Mr. Collins eagerly assented, and after a brief scouring of shelves and side tables, a book was produced. But when handed to Mr. Collins, he looked at it with disdain. It was, Mary saw, her mother's latest volume borrowed from the circulating library.
"I beg your pardon, but I'm afraid I must disoblige you. I never read novels. Perhaps you have something else?"
Mary considered him hopefully. Perhaps his literary tastes were closer to her own than to her mother's. In the ensuing bustle, whilst new books were searched for, it occurred to Mary that he might enjoy one of her own favourite titles. Rushing to fetch it from its accustomed place, she handed it to him quickly, before any alternative could be offered. "Perhaps this might be more to your liking, sir?"
"Ah, yes, Fordyce's Sermons," he replied approvingly. "We shall not go wrong with this."
Mary dropped her eyes and smiled with secret pride as he opened the familiar pages and began. He read exactly as might have been expected, slowly, portentously, and with exaggerated solemnity. But Mary was thrilled to hear the well-known phrases spoken aloud without irony or disdain. As his voice rolled on, she began to consider whether there might be other interests she and her cousin shared. Had he read Blair's sermons, she wondered, or perhaps even something by Bishop Berkeley? How exciting it would be to discuss them with a like-minded reader. Her thoughts dwelt so keenly upon such rich possibilities that she did not see Lydia fidgeting with boredom on the other side of the room, and her sister's sudden exclamation was almost as great a surprise to Mary as it was to Mr. Collins.
"Do you know, Mama, that my Uncle Phillips talks of turning away Richard, and that, if he does, Colonel Forster will hire him? I shall walk into Meryton tomorrow to hear more about it."
Lydia was immediately bid by her two eldest sisters to hold her tongue, whilst Mrs. Bennet apologised profusely. In truth, only Mary genuinely regretted that they should hear no more, for Mr. Collins was seriously offended and had closed the book with an aggrieved frown.
"I have often observed how little young ladies are interested by books of a serious stamp, though written solely for their benefit. It amazes me, I confess."
Just at that moment, coffee finally arrived, and in the distraction created by its being laid out, Mary leant across to Mr. Collins and sought to soothe his ruffled dignity. "I am very sorry you did not continue, sir. I am a great admirer of Dr. Fordyce, and have read the sermons through on many occasions. This is my copy, you know."
"I am glad to hear that one amongst you is interested in advantageous instruction. It is true nothing is so beneficial to young ladies as well-directed reading, though not all are disposed to appreciate its importance."
He shot an affronted glance at Lydia, who, absorbed in a low, confidential conversation with Kitty, did not notice at all. Mary persevered. "As you think so highly of Dr. Fordyce, I should very much like to hear what other authors you enjoy. Not all young women are indifferent to works of a serious nature. I myself am very keen to discover other books that may be of benefit to me."
"That is very commendable in you, and I am glad to hear it. But I hope you will forgive me if our conversation is postponed for another time. If you will excuse me, I intend to propose myself to your excellent father for a game of backgammon. I feel I can be of no further use amongst the ladies.
With the smallest of ingratiating bows, he was gone. As she lay in bed that night, Mary turned the events of the day over in her mind. There was no doubt Mr. Collins could not be considered an amiable man. His manner was pompous. He was puffed up with self-regard, and during the short time he had spent in their company, he had done everything in his power to make himself look ridiculous. And yet, for all his failings, or perhaps even because of them, the flicker of sympathy she had felt for him as her father encouraged him to display ever more incriminating evidence of his foolishness had not been entirely extinguished. Beneath his stiff and artificial manner, she thought she had caught a glimpse of something uncertain, a nervousness hidden behind his smirk. He was not at ease with himself, and she could not help feeling a little sorry for him. She knew what it was to believe herself out of place and always in the wrong, and thought that he might too. His choosing to read from Dr. Fordyce had only increased her sense of fellow feeling. It was true he had not seized the opportunity to discuss with her other works of a similar nature, and she had to admit that his conversation did not suggest his intellect was of the most acute and brilliant kind. But perhaps during his stay she could learn more about his tastes. They might read together, discussing their opinions at the end of a morning of quiet study. She saw herself, little by little, winning his confidence, encouraging him to think of her as a partner in serious study. It would be agreeable to have a companion in pursuits she had hitherto undertaken alone. Suddenly, she was startlingly aware of the direction her thoughts were taking. Was it possible she was considering Mr. Collins as a possible suitor? She was shocked and a little ashamed. She had not consciously intended to think of him in such a light, and yet she could not deny the possibility had begun to take shape in her mind. What was she thinking? She had met him only for a few hours, and his character had hardly been such as to captivate or amuse. It was true she had felt sorry for the treatment he had received at her family's hands, and of course there was Fordyce. But a shared taste for improving literature was surely not enough to begin thinking of him as a potential husband. Charlotte, of course, would have laughed at her misgivings, arguing that a couple brought together by a common interest stood as good a chance as any of finding happiness, and that an appreciation for the works of Dr. Fordyce might be a firmer foundation for marriage than the turbulent emotions of love. Mary's rational mind saw the sense of such arguments. But when she applied them to herself and Mr. Collins, her spirit faltered. She thought she might in time learn to live with a man whom she did not love, if that was her destiny. Perhaps she would become as adept as Charlotte in fixing her eyes on the practical benefits of a loveless union. But she was not sure she could endure to be tied forever to a husband she could not respect. The marriage of her parents, always before her eyes, demonstrated only too clearly the miserable consequences of such a choice. Where there was no real esteem, contempt and bitterness soon followed. If she was seriously to consider Mr. Collins as her partner in life, she must find something worthwhile in him, or she really should not continue to think of him at all. At first, this did not seem an easy task. When she recalled the many ways in which he had exposed himself during the evening, her heart sank. But she urged herself to think more coolly, to try to rise above the first impressions he had made. And, with a little effort, her determination eventually proved almost equal to the challenge. Looked at with dispassion, it might be argued that none of his sins were of the very worst kind. Yes, he was foolish and silly, but he did not seem vicious or degraded. No scandal attached to his name. He was neither a drunkard nor a debtor, and his temper gave no suggestion of violence. Most of his faults, thought Mary, lay in the way he presented himself to the world, and that, perhaps, was not so grievous a crime. He was still a young man, and his errors need not be fixed and unalterable. Some of the worst might be corrected in time, especially if he were to fall under the influence of a sensible woman. Under her gentle discipline, he might learn a little restraint. Encouraged by her delicacy, he might acquire some dignity. and directed by her taste, he could perhaps become the kind of man for whom a wife could eventually come to feel, if not love, then at least some mild regard. And if Mr. Collins was capable of becoming a better man, why should she not be the one who effected his transformation? None of her sisters would be prepared to take on such a task, nor equal to achieving it. She was the one Bennet daughter who, by accepting Mr. Collins, might make it possible for him to grow into a more sensible being. Mary shifted in her bed, aware of where her thoughts were leading her. Perhaps it was her duty to marry Mr. Collins, to save him from himself. Of course, in becoming his wife, she would secure her own future as well as his. As Mrs. Collins, she would be both comfortable and secure. At the same time, she would deliver the greatest prize of all, for marriage to him would keep the Bennet property in the Bennet family line and remove forever the looming shadow of the entail. She smiled bitterly to herself in the darkness as she imagined her mother's response when she understood it was the least loved and most disregarded of her daughters to whom she owed the prospect of a happy old age. It was a triumph that would offend Mrs. Bennet very deeply. That alone rendered the prospect of marriage to Mr. Collins almost worthwhile. She turned over, unable to settle, and vigorously shook out her pillow. All this was very well, but what chance did she have of securing him? There was little doubt he was ready to marry. He had hinted to Mrs. Bennet this was his intention, as his very presence at Longbourn suggested he was disposed to make a choice from one of his five cousins, although Mary was candid enough to admit there was no reason to suppose Mr. Collins had any preference for her. It had been Jane's lovely face which had attracted his attention. But then she remembered Charlotte's insistence that a man's preference might be turned round by a woman truly determined to win him. Charlotte would have told Mary her task was clear. She must communicate her readiness for matrimony by any means necessary, flattering Mr. Collins's pride and pumping up his self-regard, guiding him step by careful step towards the realization that she and she alone was the only sensible choice for him to make. As she turned it over in her mind, it seemed to Mary that dispassionate reasoning, of the kind advocated so forcefully by Charlotte and, indeed, by all her favorite authors, admitted no doubt in the matter. Marrying Mr. Collins was the rational thing to do. Both of them would benefit from such a union. He offered her escape from an uncertain destiny, the possibility of a comfortable home, and the salvation of her family's finances. She promised him a sympathetic temper, an interest in serious subjects, and the prospect that, by managing his worst excesses, she might enable him to present a more pleasing figure to the world. But even as Mary congratulated herself on the clarity of her thinking, something within her resisted, her heart rejecting the conclusions her head had so easily arrived at. Could she really imagine herself as Mr. Collins's wife? What if she were wrong, and there was no better Mr. Collins for her to discover? Could she bear to be yoked to a man who could not open his mouth without provoking derision? Even if it proved possible to cajole him into making her an offer, was there really any possibility of their making each other even tolerably happy? Pity and self-interest on her part, coupled with ignorance and naivety on his, seemed very fragile foundations on which to build a life together, whatever Charlotte might say. Unbidden, an image sprang into her mind of John Sparrow at the Meryton Assembly, holding out his hand to invite her to dance. She remembered them smiling together, their shyness dissolving under the pleasure they'd discovered in each other's company. He had held her little bag and offered to take her spectacles out and clean them with the cuff of his shirt when no one was looking. They had both laughed, and then they had danced again. Life with Mr. Collins would never be like that, she thought. But then she could hardly expect to meet a John Sparrow again, a man who had, for the first time in her life, made her feel carefree and at ease. Those few happy hours with him had been but a little thing, she told herself, quickly snuffed out by the sneers of those around her and by her own timidity. But it had given her a glimpse of what happiness felt like, and that was hard to erase from her mind. Now it was over, dead and buried, never to be repeated. John Sparrow was many, many miles away and would not return. It did no good to repine. It was not long since she had assured Lizzie every impulse of feeling should be guided by reason. Now she must apply that lesson to herself. Her choices were few and of too much importance to be influenced by unruly emotions. Sense, and not sensibility, must be her guide. Chapter 23. In the morning, as Mary was pushing extra pins into her hair in an attempt to secure it, Mrs. Hill came quietly into her room. "So your cousin is arrived, miss?"
"He is indeed."
"And what do you think of him? What kind of man is he?"
"I'm afraid he hasn't won many friends in the house. My sisters think him dull, and my father has decided he is a fool. But you are not to repeat that, I beg."
"But what about you, miss? I asked your opinion of him."
Mary peered into the mirror. Her hair was not a success. Without a word, Mrs. Hill picked up a brush, took out the pins, and let it down. As she worked, Mary decided to speak as candidly as she could. She trusted Mrs. Hill and thought it would help to express her thoughts aloud.
"He does seem absurd at times," she began, "but I don't believe there is anything really wicked about him. I think he is unsure and uncertain, and that makes him inclined to talk too much to no good purpose. He believes his flattery will please those to whom he speaks, but the result is often the exact reverse."
"You feel sorry for him, then?"
"A little. He is such a tempting target for my father's teasing that it is impossible not to feel some sympathy for him, although I admit no one else seems to think as I do."
Mrs. Hill was now twisting Mary's hair into a smooth knot with practiced skill, anchoring it securely at the nape of her neck.
"Does that mean you might look at him in a friendly manner?"
"That's a very direct question."
"I'm sure you know what I mean," replied Mrs. Hill, unperturbed. "I wonder whether you have thought about him in a marital way. He talks like a reading man. And he's already asked to use the library. Your mother wants me to make sure it's dusted this morning. You'd have your books in common. He isn't a showy sort of gentleman. Not someone to value a pretty face above all other considerations."
Mary took a green and gold ribbon from her dressing table and began to run it absently through her fingers.
"You say that, but he hasn't taken his eyes off Jane since he arrived."
"Well, we know her thoughts are elsewhere, and likely to stay that way, I should think."
"If Jane refused him, I'm sure he'd think of Elizabeth next. I should be a very poor third choice."
"I shan't reply to that. You know it makes me sad to hear you so hard upon yourself. But I doubt Miss Elizabeth would have him. You might still have a chance. Would you like me to put that ribbon in your hair?"
Mary looked at it, surprised, as if she had not known it was in her hand.
No, I don't think so. It's too bright for me."
She placed it hurriedly back on the dressing table. "But even if he could be persuaded to make me an offer, what kind of happiness do you think I could look forward to with him?"
Mrs. Hill considered her handiwork, pushing a last pin into Mary's hair. "They say marriage is a lottery, and none of us knows if we've drawn a winning ticket until it's too late."
She passed Mary a small mirror so that she could see her head from the back.
"But whatever you think of him, as his wife you'd be mistress of Longbourn, and that's something to consider, is it not?"
Mary stared into the mirror, contemplating her neatly dressed hair.
"In my opinion," concluded Mrs. Hill, "you have as good a chance of catching him as anyone. You should think very hard about it before letting someone else steal him from under your nose. A man like him, whatever his little annoyances, won't be around forever."
She laid down the combs, and having delivered herself of the point she had always intended to make, left the room. For a few seconds, Mary did not move. sitting and thinking before she rose and pulled on her shawl. As she did so, she felt a strand of her hair slip down. Angry, she thrust in a pin with too much force, making her head throb as she walked downstairs to breakfast. She arrived in the hall just in time to see Mrs. Bennet follow Mr. Collins out of the drawing room. He looked self-conscious but pleased with himself. Her mother seemed excited, as though she could scarcely contain what she had just been told. Throughout the meal, she beamed at Mr. Collins, handing him the hottest rolls and helping him to the butter and jam. Mary watched him closely. She thought she could guess at the contents of a conversation that had left both him and her mother so ebullient. He must have spoken to her about his intentions. A shiver of apprehension passed through her as she contemplated what this meant. She must decide now if she intended to follow her head or her heart, whether she would listen to the promptings of duty and self-interest, or cover her ears and hope against hope for something better. Her mind was soon made up. She said nothing until everyone else had gone, and only she and her mother remained. As Mrs. Bennet played idly with the remains of a slice of toast, Mary got up and carefully closed the door.
"Excuse me, ma'am, but I wonder if I might ask you something."
Mrs. Bennet nodded absently.
"Is it your belief that Mr. Collins has come here to ask for one of us in marriage?"
Her mother looked up, surprised.
"What do you mean by asking me that? Have you been listening at doors?"
"Indeed, I have not. He has dropped several hints that suggest that might be his intention."
"And if it is, what has it to do with you? I'm not sure what you mean by questioning me."
Mary struggled on, trying to suggest a confidence she did not feel.
"I have been thinking very hard about it, and it seems to me that of all my sisters, I might be the most sensible choice for him. I think our interests coincide. We are both of a serious turn of mind, and might grow to suit each other well enough. I'm sorry to speak so boldly, but I've tried to consider the situation as rationally as I could before raising it with you."
Her voice shook a little at the end, but she did not waver. Mrs. Bennet looked at her daughter, speechless. Words seemed briefly to have failed her.
"Well, you are full of surprises, to be sure. But you are right, Mr. Collins does intend to ask for one of you girls in marriage. He told me so this morning. Of course, his first thought was Jane, but as I've explained, I have every reason to expect she will shortly be engaged to a gentleman of rank and fortune."
She smiled into the middle distance, the mere thought of such a happy event enough to please her.
"I suggested he transfer his hopes to Lizzie, and he seemed pleased enough to do so."
"Was that entirely wise? I don't think there's any chance of Lizzie accepting him. Their dispositions are so very different. She's in no hurry to marry and can expect many other offers."
Mrs. Bennet began to grow annoyed.
"If he couldn't have Jane, it was Lizzie he wanted, and it was hardly the moment to suggest alternatives. What am I to do? Offer him around the family like a parcel? I'm sure he would never have thought of you. Your name wasn't mentioned at all."
Mary flinched. The pin she had pushed so clumsily into her head was hurting her, but this was not the moment to adjust it.
"I'm sorry if I've angered you," she continued. "I didn't intend to make any claims for myself. I know I don't possess the attractions of Jane or Lizzie, but I thought, as I am the only sister likely to look favourably upon him, it would be sensible to direct his attentions towards me. If he made an offer, I should feel obliged to accept him. It would keep Longbourn for us, besides taking your least marriageable daughter off your hands. Those and those alone have been my motives in speaking."
Mrs. Bennet was not mollified.
"That's finely said, but I don't think Lizzie will refuse him. I intend to make sure she does not. There will be no need for anyone in reserve. You are not to meddle in things that don't concern you, and you are expressly forbidden to mention any of this to Elizabeth. To be frank, Mary, I'm amazed at your presumption."
She stood up, indignantly gathering her skirt before her.
"I don't want to hear another word from you on the subject, and your hair has come down at the back. Please attend to it."
When her mother had gone, Mary poured herself some tea. At first, her hand shook slightly, but by the time she raised the cup to her mouth, she was calmer. Mrs. Bennet's words shocked her very much. She knew her mother had no hopes she would make a marriage of the kind she dreamt of for her other daughters. But Mary had not realized until now how little she featured in her mother's plans at all. Nothing, it seemed, was to be done for her. She was unworthy of any consideration, not fit even to serve as a consolation prize to a disappointed man. If proof had been needed that Charlotte was right when she insisted a young woman must unflinchingly pursue her own best interests, she had surely received it this morning. She could hear the servants outside waiting to come and clear the table, and knew it was time to leave. For the merest instant, as she got up from her chair, she wondered if her mother's rejection was in fact a blessing in disguise, that she was being offered a chance to think again, that she was not required to lay herself out to please a man she hardly knew and wondered if she could ever love. But it was a thought she quickly buried. There was no alternative to Mr. Collins. Even Mrs. Hill had urged him upon her. She was foolish to imagine she deserved anything else. If her mother would not help her secure him, then she must do so alone. Chapter 24. As Mary walked into the hall, she had already begun to turn over in her mind how she might proceed. She knew she had no talent for the playfulness which Elizabeth deployed so easily. She would never learn how to flirt or tease. She could see only one way of attracting Mr. Collins's attention. She must do everything possible to alert him to the interests they shared, demonstrate to him by every means in her power that in terms of taste and disposition, she was the only Bennet sister who might offer him a reasonable chance of happiness. So absorbed was she in these thoughts that she hardly noticed her two younger sisters heading towards her along the passage, with their usual air of barely suppressed excitement. Lydia seized her arm and spoke in a whisper loud enough to be heard in every adjacent room.
"Unless you wish to be teased and annoyed by the dullest man in the neighbourhood, go as fast as you can past the library. He is in there, wandering about and pretending to look at books."
Kitty looked over her shoulder, as if she feared they might have been followed.
"I think he saw us, for he called out as we went past, but we pretended not to hear."
She caught Lydia's eye, and they both laughed. "That was unkind and disrespectful," declared Mary. "Mr. Collins is a guest in our house and deserves proper consideration from us all." Lydia rolled her eyes and pulled a face.
"You are very welcome to offer him all the consideration you want, proper or otherwise, but we intend walking into Meryton to escape him. Come with us if you wish, unless you'd rather stay and listen to another of his lectures."
"I would rather spend the morning hearing Mr. Collins read an interesting book than wander about Meryton mooning after officers."
"Just as you like," replied Lydia nonchalantly. "We obviously have very different ideas about what is interesting. Kitty and I will go and put on our boots and leave you to be improved."
They bustled away, and Mary, conscious she had yet again been made to look a prig, continued on her way to the library. There she found Mr. Collins, a large folio open on the table before him. He looked up as she entered, his expression registering neither pleasure nor surprise at her arrival. He wished her good morning and returned to his book. Mary took up her usual position at her little table and opened a volume of her own, but it was soon evident from his sighs and fidgets that he was not engaged by his reading. Mary plucked up her courage. This was exactly the kind of opportunity she must learn to seize.
"Excuse me, sir, but it doesn't appear you're quite satisfied with the book you have chosen. I know my father's library very well and would be happy to help you find something more to your liking."
That's very polite, but I assure you I'm happy with what I have."
"My father's system of cataloguing is of his own devising, and the logic is not always apparent to those who do not know it. I could point out where he keeps works of moral and philosophical interest."
Thank you, but I will content myself with this for the time being."
He turned the pages one after the other, his attention clearly elsewhere. Mary made herself try again.
"I was very sorry you weren't able to finish your reading from Dr. Fordyce yesterday.
I found it most instructive. Mr. Collins inclined his head very slightly in acknowledgement. I should be very glad to hear more, if you ever felt moved. Before she could finish her sentence, Mr. Bennet came into the room. Mr. Collins stood up, all attention, and made a formal bow.
I hope, sir, you will excuse my intruding into your place of study. I took the liberty of acceding to the invitation extended by you with such generosity last night to think of your library as my own.
Mr. Bennet murmured the briefest acknowledgement and seated himself at his desk.
Anyone is welcome here, provided they abide by the rules of the house. As Mary may have told you, I encourage the preservation of a companionable silence as being most conducive to civilized reflection.
Mr. Collins expressed his eager willingness to comply, and for a few minutes nothing was heard but his page turning. But Mary saw he was still unsettled, and it was not long before he addressed Mr. Bennet directly.
Your library, sir, is blessed with very elegant proportions and a quantity of natural light.
Mr. Bennet looked up, a hint of irritation discernible in his expression.
It has neither the size nor the scale of Lady Catherine's library at Rosings Park, continued Mr. Collins blithely, but it is of very respectable proportions for a gentleman's residence such as your own.
I'm glad it meets with your approval.
Oh, indeed it does, sir, and your gardens are admirable too. Although their size must limit their ambitions, they are extremely well kept and make a very pleasurable sight.
Again, I am indebted to you. I imagine, however, that the grounds at Rosings are of a different degree of excellence.
Oh, yes. Lady Catherine always says the long walk and the parterre exceed in perfection anything to be found in the county. I have often agreed with her that this is so. Nothing is as noble as the view from the north terrace towards the ha-ha.
Mr. Bennet closed his book.
Your thoughts seem more directed towards the pleasures of the outdoors than to study this morning. It seems most unfair that you should confine yourself inside.
Lydia and Kitty are, I believe, readying themselves to walk into Meryton. Mr. Collins looked uncertain.
Elizabeth and Jane intend to accompany them. I suggest you join them. It will be a very cheerful party for you all.
At the mention of Lizzie's name, Mr. Collins hastily stood up.
I should be delighted to attend them. I shall go and find them directly.
He did not look at Mary as he hurried from the room. Should she follow him? She was not certain whether it would be fitting to rush after him. She laid down her book and tried to make up her mind. But before she could do so, Mr. Collins was heard in the hallway begging his fair cousins to wait for him. There was a clatter of boots, a flurry of voices. The front door was heard to shut. And then all was again silent.
You did not wish to go with them, Mary?
Inquired Mr. Bennet. I don't think my presence was required.
Well, at least you have the consolation of being spared your cousin's company for an hour.
I think he means well, Papa. His manner, I agree, is unfortunate, but I believe his intentions are sincere.
Do you think so? If that is indeed the case, then I think I would prefer the company of an insincere man of sense to, well, I shall not say fool because he is such a close relation.
He returned to his book in a manner intended to suggest that further conversation was at an end. Mary picked up her own volume, but now it was she who was distracted. For the rest of the morning, she brooded on what she should do next. Her thoughts went this way and that, but finally she stirred herself to action. She went to her bedroom, fetched her copy of Fordyce, and carried it to the drawing-room, where she stood looking about for a few minutes before putting it on a small table, where she thought it most likely to catch Mr. Collins's eye. Beneath it she placed Mrs. Macaulay, in case his tastes ran towards history. Satisfied, she walked to the piano and searched through her music, choosing pieces she thought he might enjoy, nothing too frivolous, and arranged them next to the keyboard. If an opportunity to play for him offered itself, she would be ready to grasp it. Then she sat down and waited for the walking party to return. After a while, she heard her mother's voice directing the laying of the table for luncheon, and a moment later, Mrs. Bennet slipped silently into the drawing-room closing the door firmly behind her.
When the others are back and we sit down at table, I do not want there to be any confusion about where each of us will be placed.
I'm sorry, Mama, but I'm not sure I understand you.
Really, Mary, I think you do. Lord knows your conversation this morning was forward enough. It does you no favours to be so missish now.
Ashamed, Mary hung her head.
Well, let me make myself understood. Mr. Collins will be seated next to Lizzie. There will be no attempts to swap seats.
Of course, I would never put myself forward in that way.
I'm very pleased to hear it. I will have no interference with my plans.
When the family assembled, Mary found herself at the furthest possible distance from Mr. Collins. It was impossible for them to have any conversation together. From her end of the table, she watched Elizabeth do all she could to deflect his attentions whilst remaining within the bounds of politeness. Mary looked on with frustrated incomprehension. How could Mrs. Bennet refuse to understand that Elizabeth would never have him? Why, indeed, did Mr. Collins not see that himself? Instead, he battled on, quite blind to Lizzie's ill-concealed distaste. It was many minutes before he drew himself reluctantly away from Elizabeth and addressed her mother instead.
I was delighted to be introduced to some gentleman of my fair cousin's acquaintance this morning.
Indeed, sir, replied
Mrs. Bennet, signalling to the servant to offer Mr. Collins another leg of chicken.
Whom did you meet?
We came upon two of the officers,
interrupted Lydia, delighted at the opportunity to talk upon her favourite topic.
Mr. Denny and another quite new one, just this minute arrived. He was not even in his red coat yet, although he said he has his commission.
His name is Mr. Wickham, added Kitty, helping herself to more peas.
And whilst we were talking to them, Mr. Bingley arrived, together with his friend, the tall, proud man who never speaks.
Oh, that would be Mr. Darcy, explained Mrs. Bennet to Mr. Collins. A very disagreeable man.
Really, ma'am, exclaimed Elizabeth, it cannot be fair to prejudice Mr. Collins against him to such a degree. We barely know the gentleman. Mrs. Bennet was unmoved.
What we have seen of him is hardly to his credit. His haughtiness gave universal offence at the last assembly. I'm sure no one has a good word to say for him.
Judge not, lest ye be judged in your turn, ventured Mary. That is what Scripture enjoins upon us. She looked towards Mr. Collins to see if he would approve.
My cousin is right, of course, he replied, favouring her with a bland smile. But society, as well as Scripture, has its claims upon us all. No one of us can afford to ignore what is owed to politeness.
He tried to catch Elizabeth's eye, but she occupied herself resolutely with her chicken.
I thought Mr. Wickham seemed rather taken by Lizzie,
suggested Lydia with a grin. Elizabeth turned back to the table, her expression outraged.
What can you mean, Lydia? Really, you are quite ridiculous.
He spoke to you far more than to any of us, and you didn't appear to mind it.
That is quite enough,
declared Mrs. Bennet sharply, with a sideways glance at Mr. Collins.
Lydia always takes these little jokes too far.
The rest of the meal proceeded in a distinctly subdued fashion. Lizzie was embarrassed, Mr. Collins piqued, and Mrs. Bennet angry. As soon as the table was cleared, Elizabeth escaped to her room, whilst Mrs. Bennet pursued Lydia into the garden, where she could be scolded away from view. Mary wandered aimlessly towards the drawing-room, where she sat at the piano and began to play. Soon she was quite lost in the music. A few minutes later, she saw Mr. Collins come in, but she continued with her playing until all the piece's loose ends had been satisfactorily tied up and its complexities resolved. When she turned to face him, he was smiling with what looked like genuine pleasure.
"My congratulations, cousin! You play with great exactness. I imagine you practice a great deal to achieve such precision."
Mary admitted this was so.
"I commend you for it. It is only through hard work that anything of value is to be achieved."
"I'm very pleased you enjoyed it."
"I have often remarked to Lady Catherine that her daughter, Miss de Bourgh, would no doubt have been an excellent musician if her health had permitted her to learn an instrument.
The weakness of her constitution unquestionably deprived us of a musician of the very greatest accomplishment.
I'm sorry to hear that, sir. I would be happy to play for you again, if you wish.
Sadly, I must deny myself that pleasure, as I am engaged to your mother, who is to show me the disposition of her backstairs linen cupboards. Lady Catherine has condescended to suggest some improvements in that line might not go amiss in my humble parsonage, so I am keen to avail myself of Mrs. Bennet's expert knowledge whilst I may.
He stood up, making his accustomed bow.
But I must thank you for allowing me to listen to you. It filled an empty moment most pleasurably.
After his departure, Mary sat at the keyboard reflecting. Although he had refused her offer to continue, Mr. Collins seemed to have enjoyed hearing her play. Indeed, he had never before appeared so animated in her presence. She stroked the keys noiselessly as she considered the implications of this. Perhaps it was music and not reading that would best attract his attention. She struck a single chord, which echoed round the empty room. If that was so, and the more she considered it, the more she was persuaded she was right, then she must do all in her power to show off her skills at the piano to their very best advantage, so that he could not help but notice both them and herself. She was still wondering how this might be achieved when the door burst open and Kitty rushed in.
"We just heard the best possible news," she gasped, her hat awry. "We've run in to tell everyone." "Yes, yes," cried Lydia, following fast behind her. "There's going to be a ball at Netherfield, and it's fixed for a week today."
She paused to catch her breath.
"Mr. Bingley came in person to invite us. He met Lizzie and Jane in the garden. We saw him just before he went away. What news, eh?" "He asked us all," cried Kitty. "Even Mr. Collins. Mama will be so excited."
"Did Mr. Bingley not think it proper to come in and ask our mother himself?" asked Mary.
"He was with his sisters. They had not the time," said Kitty.
"That doesn't seem very polite."
"Really, Mary," Lydia exclaimed, "what does it matter who asked whom? Anyway, I'm sure it was his dreadful sisters who declined to come in. They make it quite clear they think we're beneath them, all those simpering smiles to Jane and nasty little sniggers to each other. Don't imagine I haven't seen them, but I don't care. He has behaved admirably. He said he should hold a ball, and he has been true to his word."
"Shall you go, Mary?" asked Kitty. Mary picked up her music, turning the question over in her mind. If Mr. Collins was to be there, and if she was serious in her attempts to arouse his interest, she was clearly obliged to attend. The dance could be as much an opportunity for her as it was for any of her sisters. "I think I might. I can work in the morning, and I think it right occasionally to join in evening entertainments. Society has its claims upon us all, and I think some moments of recreation and amusement are desirable for everyone." Lydia burst into laughter.
"You sound exactly like Mr. Collins. You were clearly meant for each other. What a pity it is that he has eyes only for Lizzie."
At dinner that night, all conversation was directed to the coming ball. Mrs. Bennet was consumed with anticipation. She had convinced herself the ball was intended entirely as a compliment to Jane, and, brushing away her daughter's embarrassment, began to debate how quickly it would be followed by an offer from Mr. Bingley. Her husband paid no attention to his wife's speculations, but to the surprise of his family, announced that he too would attend. Since Bingley had done him the honour to ask him, he should go and drink his wine and eat his supper and be as content as a sensible man could be in such a situation. Elizabeth did not usually address Mr. Collins more than was required by the demands of politeness, but now, allowing goodwill to triumph over dislike, she unbent sufficiently to ask her cousin if, as a clergyman, he thought it proper to accept his invitation and join in the evening's amusements. He gave his answer very determinedly.
"I am by no means of the opinion, I assure you, that a ball of this kind given by a young man of character to respectable people can have any evil tendency. And I am so far from objecting to dancing myself that I shall hope to be honoured with the hands of all my fair cousins in the course of the evening."
Lydia suppressed a giggle. Mrs. Bennet glared at her as Kitty, Jane, and Lizzie stared away, in any direction but his. Only Mary steeled herself to gaze at him expectantly. But Mr. Collins turned, as she had suspected he would, towards Lizzie.
"I take this opportunity of soliciting yours, Miss Elizabeth, for the first dance especially."
Elizabeth looked stricken, but was forced to agree. Mr. Collins made no similar offer to Mary, which merely confirmed the conclusion she had arrived at earlier. If she was to make any impression at all upon him, it must be through her skill at the piano. Her looks could not help her, and he had barely acknowledged her studiousness, although she had done her utmost to parade it before him. Music was the last remaining lure by which he might be persuaded to notice her, and the Netherfield ball offered the perfect opportunity to display the full extent of her talent. There she would perform with such brilliance that neither he nor anyone else would be able to ignore her. She sat back in her chair, pleased to have a plan. She would arrange to have extra instruction from her music teacher to ensure her playing was at its very best. This was too important a moment to leave anything to chance. Chapter 25. Miss Allen, Mary's piano instructress, was thin, grave, and silent. A woman who had perfected the art of self-effacement to such a degree that when she was not at Longbourn, Mary found it hard to recall exactly what she looked like or how old she might be. She was the unmarried daughter of a curate, living in lodgings above the milliner's shop, from which cramped and dingy rooms she strove night and day to preserve her precarious hold on gentility. It was Miss Allen's fate that haunted Mary's darkest hours, her sad and anxious face which sprang into her mind when she imagined what the future held if she did not marry. For that reason, Mary had called upon Miss Allen's services rather less in recent months than before. But today, here she was, toiling up the Longbourn Drive, her shabby cloth bag heavy with sheets of new music for Mary to consider. Together, they spent the morning studying them, and by midday they had decided on three pieces. Mary would begin with a sonata by Haydn, intended to display her hard-won proficiency at the keyboard, go on with a few Scottish airs, designed to make her listeners smile, and finish with a selection from The Harmonious Blacksmith. "Your choices feel entirely right," concluded Miss Allen, as she packed up her things and readied herself to walk the 2 miles to her next lesson. "The Haydn will impress everyone who hears it, and the airs will be very cheerful. Everyone will have the words to Robin Adair in their heads." Mary closed the piano lid. An idea had occurred to her earlier in the morning, and she wished to find out Miss Allen's opinion of it. "I have been asking myself if I'm offering enough to the company by merely playing the song. I thought I might venture to sing it, too. The effect would be very fine if I could manage both. What do you think?" Miss Allen buckled her bag and fussed with her gloves. "I'm not sure your vocal talents are as strong as your playing. If you wish to show yourself to your greatest advantage, I suggest you concentrate on what you do best and confine yourself to the keyboard." Usually this would have been enough to quash Mary's ambitions, but not today. She had set her mind on achieving something spectacular and was not to be easily deterred. "Other ladies will play and sing." "We cannot all excel equally at everything we do." Miss Allen looked tired as she stood up to leave. "Miss Elizabeth's abilities might be said to be the exact opposite of your own. Her voice is strong, but her playing lacks discipline. You, on the other hand, are an extremely competent player, but your voice is not your greatest asset."
"You are very candid, to be sure."
Miss Allen sighed.
"I don't think I would be serving you by telling you only what you wish to hear. Your playing will please everyone, but your singing is perhaps best enjoyed by your family alone. I mean it kindly, and have no wish to offend you."
Mary assured Miss Allen that she did not take her words ill, but as she stood at the window, watching the music teacher make her way down the drive, Mary knew she would not follow her advice. She went back to the piano and placed a new sheet of music on the stand with a most determined air. For once she would not be told what to do, would not meekly accept that Elizabeth must always surpass her in everything she undertook. She would practice for 3 hours every morning until the day of the ball, exercising her voice until it matched the proficiency of her fingers. Hard work and dedication should supply what nature had not, making it impossible that Mr. Collins, and indeed everyone else, should not be amazed by the virtuosity of her performance. Chapter 26. Mrs. Hill was delighted when Mary asked her to iron the golden cream dress as she intended to wear it to the Netherfield ball.
"I was afraid you were going to be stubborn and refuse it. This is exactly the right occasion to show yourself off."
The next few days passed in a flurry of practice and preparation. When the night of the ball finally arrived, Mary felt she was as ready as she would ever be. She had devoted every spare hour to the piano, rehearsing her pieces until she knew them so well that she could have played them in her sleep. She had been more circumspect with her singing, partly as she was afraid of tiring her voice, but also because she did not wish to reveal to her family her intention to sing as well as play. Miss Allen's response to her suggestion had not been what she hoped to hear. She would not risk any further discouragement by announcing it to anyone else. The surprise would be all the greater when they heard her perform. The knowledge that she had made every possible effort, that no one could have worked harder, soothed her nerves somewhat as Mrs. Hill helped her get ready. When she put on the dress, it too felt right. Turning this way and that in front of her mirror, she saw that its bright airiness still flattered her, that its simplicity worked well alongside the plain style in which Mrs. Hill had arranged her hair. Mary was satisfied. She would not provoke gasps of admiration, but she looked neatly put together. She took a final glance at her reflection, and as she did so, all unbidden, a memory flashed into her mind of John Sparrow smiling at her. It was a pang to the heart, but with a great strength of will, she suppressed it. It would not do. She breathed a little faster as she left her room and walked down the stairs, but she forced herself not to dwell upon it. She could not allow herself to become agitated. Nothing was to interfere with the serene state of mind her performance would require. When she arrived in the hall, she found her parents, Kitty and Lydia, waiting there, ready to leave. Mrs. Bennet's temper had not been improved by standing about, and she relieved some of her anger by scolding Mary vigorously for her tardiness. But when, a few minutes later, neither Jane, Elizabeth nor Mr. Collins had appeared, her patience was exhausted.
"I shall be extremely vexed if Lady Lucas arrives before we do. Lydia, go up and ask them what they are about."
"I'm sure they are busy beautifying themselves," declared Mr. Bennet, "eager to look their best for any marriageable young men who might be found at tonight's entertainment. I should have thought such close attention to their interests would have merited your entire approval, my dear."
"That might be pardonable in Jane," replied Mrs. Bennet, "for she has Mr. Bingley to consider. But who has Lizzie to please?"
"Perhaps Mr. Wickham?"
suggested Lydia with a look of mock innocence which provoked her mother still further.
"If you knew how my nerves are troubling me at this very minute, Lydia, you would not say such things. And where, pray, is Mr. Collins?" she wailed. "I thought he, at least, had more consideration."
"He is, no doubt, hard-pressed to choose an outfit that will suggest both his high opinion of himself and his readiness to flatter his superiors at every possible opportunity," observed Mr. Bennet smoothly. "It is a considerable requirement to ask of a coat and shirt. We may be here for quite some time."
Mrs. Bennet had no opportunity to reply, as, at that very moment, the three latecomers arrived together in the hall. Indeed, neither she nor any of the other Bennets were required to speak for quite some time, as Mr. Collins at once began upon a profuse apology and a lengthy account of a lost cravat, a soliloquy which, being so often repeated, occupied most of the journey to Netherfield. When their carriage pulled up outside Netherfield, the house seemed to Mary more imposing than she remembered. The entrance was lit with several flaming torches, upon which Mr. Bennet directed his most amused smile, but Mary privately thought them rather fine. The interior was even more grand, with some very imposing furniture and pictures. Mary stood before one, trying to identify the artist, when Mr. Bingley advanced to welcome them, radiating his usual good humour to all, although his greeting for Jane was particularly heartfelt. Mary wished Mrs. Bennet had not chosen to remark on the fact by nudging Mr. Bennet quite so noticeably. But she did not think of it any further once they were in the public rooms, which were packed full of people and alive with the noise of excited conversation. "A positive rout," murmured Elizabeth, as they looked around for someone they knew. Across the room stood Mr. Bingley's sisters, imperious, heads held high, and by their side was his reserved and haughty friend, who, catching sight of Elizabeth, made her an unexpectedly gracious bow.
"Look, Lizzie," whispered Jane. "I believe Mr. Darcy is greeting you. Look, he is bowing directly towards you."
Elizabeth made the briefest of acknowledgements and turned abruptly away.
"He really is insupportable, teasing me in this way. Let us ignore him. I think I see Charlotte over there beside the fireplace."
It was a fortnight since Charlotte had been at Longbourn, and there was much news to impart. Having pointed out Mr. Collins to her friend, Elizabeth enjoyed describing his oddities and quirks, retelling all his silliest speeches to so much effect that Charlotte could not help but laugh.
"Is he really so ridiculous a figure? Come, Mary, you shall tell me the truth."
"He doesn't always present himself to his best advantage, but I don't think there is any real harm in him."
"That is very lukewarm praise."
"Well, you may judge for yourself," observed Elizabeth, "for he is approaching us this very moment." The musicians had struck up, and Mr. Collins had come to claim Elizabeth for the dance. With many professions of regret for removing her from the company of her charming companions, he led his cousin towards the floor. Charlotte surveyed them keenly as they went.
"He is a clergyman, then. Does he have a decent living?"
Mary explained as fully as possible everything she could recall about Lady Catherine, the generosity of her patronage, her marked condescension, and Mr. Collins's humble parsonage in Kent. "I suppose in the fullness of time he will also inherit Longbourn. As my father likes to say, once he is dead, Mr. Collins may turn us all out whenever he wishes." To Mary's surprise, Charlotte took her hand, holding it for a few moments, then just as briskly removed it. Her gesture conveyed her sympathy more powerfully than anything she might have said. Both were silent for a moment, until Charlotte spoke again. "So for all the frailties which amuse Lizzie," she observed quietly, "Mr. Collins is in many ways a very eligible young man."
"That's certainly how my mother sees it," replied Mary.
"She is determined he'll marry one of us. At the moment, her preference, and it would seem his own, is for Lizzie." Charlotte drew back, astonished.
"I should have thought that most unlikely."
"That is my opinion exactly," declared Mary, relieved to be able to discuss Mr. Collins with a disinterested listener. "Everything he says annoys her, and she does all she can to avoid him."
"Poor man," observed Charlotte wryly. "I would not wish your sister's disdain upon anyone, but although he has not been so fortunate as to please Lizzie, it is not impossible that another woman might accept him."
"I'm sure you're right," said Mary.
"No one could call him sensible, but he has qualities which might be cultivated by a wife with the right turn of mind. Indeed, if he were to come under the influence of a steady, thoughtful woman, he could be much improved, and she might stand as good a chance as most of ending up tolerably content with her lot."
"Good Lord, Mary," declared Charlotte with a laugh, "the conversations we had about marriage have made a great impression upon you. When you talk in this way, I might almost be listening to myself." Mary was about to reply, for there was much more she would have liked to say on the subject of marriage and Mr. Collins, but she saw Elizabeth approaching them and knew it could not be pursued in her presence. Charlotte understood this too, and when Lizzie arrived, she greeted her in a very different tone, light, bright, and unconcerned.
"So you are released from your purgatory, I see. Do tell us how it was. We were too absorbed in our conversation to pay much attention to you and Mr. Collins."
Elizabeth groaned and held out her foot.
"Every step in the wrong place,"
his shoe always ending up upon mine. If he had concentrated more and apologized less, it might not have been so trying, but as it was, well, let us just say I am finished with dancing for a while.
Charlotte, who had been peering into the far side of the room, suddenly bent her head towards Elizabeth.
You may be compelled back onto the floor more quickly than you think. Mr. Darcy is coming towards us with such cold determination that it can only mean he is about to ask you to stand up with him.
Elizabeth protested that such a thing was impossible, objected that it could not be so. But just as she had finished declaring its utter improbability, the gentleman himself arrived and stood before her. In the most formal manner, he begged the pleasure of her hand when the dancing began again. And she was so taken by surprise that she accepted. Immediately he turned on his heel and walked away, leaving Elizabeth dumbstruck at her own decision.
Whatever possessed me to agree? I can't imagine what I was thinking.
I dare say, said Charlotte consolingly, that once on the floor you will find him very agreeable.
Heaven forbid! That would be the greatest misfortune of all, to find agreeable a man whom one is determined to hate. Do not wish me such an evil.
I imagine you will bear it. I do beg you, Elizabeth, do not be such a simpleton, and make yourself unpleasant in the eyes of a man of such consequence. There is nothing at all to be gained by it.
Elizabeth argued the contrary for a while, reminding Charlotte of the many objections to Mr. Darcy's character, temper, and demeanour. But when the music began, not having contrived a valid excuse to snub him, as she thought he deserved, she went reluctantly to join him in the dance. Mary and Charlotte watched with curiosity to see how she would manage it. At first, she was silent and aloof. But soon she and Mr. Darcy were talking to each other with every appearance of lively animation.
Your sister has a great deal to say to a man she insists she does not like, remarked Charlotte.
Yes, agreed Mary. It's very surprising.
Perhaps she doesn't know her own feelings as well as she thinks. She may not be accustomed as we are to subjecting them to minute examination. When everything comes to you so easily, there must be little reason to ask yourself why that's so.
Together, Charlotte and Mary walked towards the supper table and watched the dancing draw to a close.
I hear you are to play for us later tonight, observed Charlotte politely.
I think so, if the company is happy to hear me. I've chosen a few pieces I hope will please. For a moment, she was tempted to tell Charlotte everything. How, inspired by her words, she had begun to think of Mr. Collins as a potential husband. How impossible it had proved to attract his attention, and how, this very evening, she hoped to conquer his indifference with a remarkable performance at the keyboard. It would have been a relief to speak plainly to someone who would understand, who might have sensible advice to offer. But before she could do so, Elizabeth hurried over to them, eager to share her impressions of her dancing partner. She had only just begun to catalogue his shortcomings when they were interrupted again, this time by Mr. Collins, who bustled into their presence with news he thought they would be as keen to hear as he was to impart.
"Excuse my interrupting you, ladies, but I thought it right you should know I have made a most significant discovery."
He bent towards them with an air of the greatest solemnity.
"I have found out, by a singular accident, that there is, in this room, a distinguished relation of my patroness."
"Really, sir?" asked Charlotte. "May we know who it is?"
"You will be surprised to hear," he announced, "that it is the gentleman fortunate enough to have danced the last set with you, Miss Elizabeth. Mr. Darcy, it appears, is a nephew of Lady Catherine de Bourgh. What have you to say to that?"
"I suppose," began Mary, when no one else volunteered a reply, "it may be said to show how very small are the circles in which we all move, how close are the ties that bind us."
"Yes," agreed Charlotte. "It is remarkable how..."
She did not finish her sentence. Elizabeth broke in, her voice full of the urgency of one to whom a dreadful idea has just occurred.
"Sir, please tell me you do not plan to introduce yourself to Mr. Darcy."
Mr. Collins looked a little affronted.
"Well, of course I shall. Indeed, I feel I must apologize for not having done so earlier.
I shall explain I was unaware of the connection between us."
In vain did Elizabeth attempt to dissuade him. Mr. Darcy was of a proud disposition, she explained, and would not welcome uninvited familiarity. If the connection was to be acknowledged, then it fell to Mr. Darcy as the superior in consequence to make the first approach. But Mr. Collins was not to be swayed. Adopting an expression which seemed to Lizzie to combine supplication and presumption in equally shameful measure, he made his way to the group amongst whom Mr. Darcy stood and began to speak. It was perhaps fortunate that they were too far away to hear exactly what was said, but Mr. Collins's voice was strong and carrying, and the words apology and Lady Catherine de Bourgh were frequently repeated and impossible to ignore. Elizabeth closed her eyes in horror.
How could he expose himself in this way?
Charlotte watched with amusement. I think a snub has very definitely been administered. It appears that poor Mr. Collins has been soundly dismissed.
I'm afraid you're right, agreed Mary. Mr. Darcy has not deigned to notice him. Poor man. I'm sorry for him.
How can you say that?
Cried Elizabeth, smarting with humiliation, when his behaviour reflects so badly upon us all. Look at Miss Bingley smirking at her sister. Nothing could have pleased them more than to see one of our family show themselves to be so ill-bred. Charlotte took Elizabeth's arm. Come, Lizzie, there is no need to be so cross. I'm not sure why you set such store by the opinions of those you do not respect. Elizabeth was silent with anger, but she allowed herself to be gently led away from the scene of Mr. Collins's embarrassment.
Let us find somewhere a little quieter to sit, murmured Charlotte soothingly. We shall have a glass of wine and put it out of our minds.
By now, most of the chairs were full, and the only vacant seats were closer to Mrs. Bennet than either Charlotte, Elizabeth, or Mary would have preferred. From their places, they could not help but overhear everything she said. And Elizabeth's temper did not improve, as her mother loudly informed Lady Lucas of her confident expectation that Jane and Mr. Bingley would very soon be married. When Mr. Darcy and the Bingley sisters, also in search of refreshment, happened to station themselves close by, Elizabeth's misery was almost complete. Mary watched her grow more and more agitated as Mrs. Bennet's conversation went on and on, audible to anyone around them. The music could not silence her. Instead, she simply raised her voice, all the better to assure her friend that, in her view, not the least advantage of Jane's marrying so well was the likelihood of it throwing her younger daughters in the way of other rich men. At this, Elizabeth could bear no more, and stood up. Mary saw her dart a glance towards Mr. Darcy, who stared back, grave and disapproving.
Please, ma'am, I do beseech you to speak less audibly. Mr. Darcy is quite close by and cannot help but hear you.
And what is Mr. Darcy to me, pray, that I should be afraid of him? I'm sure we owe him no particular civility as to be obliged to say nothing that he might not like to hear.
Elizabeth stood up abruptly and walked away.
I'm not sure why Elizabeth is so angry, whispered Mary to Charlotte, as she watched her sister force her way through the crowd. Our mother's behaviour does not usually affect her so powerfully.
I think she is ashamed, replied Charlotte. That is a new sensation for her, because I do not believe she has ever felt such a strong desire to make a good impression on those around her.
Her own talents and vivacity have always been sufficient recommendation, but now I think she feels she is being judged by the actions of her relations. A most uncomfortable idea.
They watched as Elizabeth reappeared from the throng on the far side of the room, where she caught sight of her father, for whom she had clearly been searching. She approached him very decisively and addressed him with great feeling. He looked towards Mrs. Bennet, still gossiping with Lady Lucas, and then at Mr. Collins, who was now seen attempting to converse with a freezingly aloof Miss Bingley. To his daughter's imploring expression, he returned only his usual detached smile. Even from a distance, it was plain to Mary that he had declined to act upon Elizabeth's appeal to rein in the behaviour of his family. He laughed and touched her shoulder, but Elizabeth was not to be placated. She left him without a word. Her face was stony as she returned to her seat. She sat a little apart from Charlotte and Mary, making it clear she did not wish to talk.
"There is nothing to be done but humour her as best we can," whispered Charlotte. "Whilst this mood is upon her, I think it essential not to provoke her further."